From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our holiday week series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Singer Margaret Whiting learned how to phrase a song from the songwriters themselves. Her father was composer Richard Whiting, who wrote the songs Hooray for Hollywood, Too Marvelous for Words, and My Ideal. Also, we listened back to a 1985 interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. He wrote many songs for movies, including Teach Me Tonight, All the Way, Come Fly With Me, and Call Me Irresponsible. Several of his songs were written for Frank Sinatra. And critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new series of original Broadway cast recordings from shows that didn't succeed but which contain songs that shouldn't be forgotten. Songs from Hollywood and Broadway coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall. A bomb went off today in Baghdad near a crowded restaurant. NPR's Julie McCarthy was near the restaurant and describes the scene.
From what I could see, there was terrific damage that has been done to the restaurant and even greater damage done to the house next door that was just a gaping hole. One eyewitness who had been inside the restaurant said that he came out, stumbled outside, saw that three cars have been turned over on top of his car. There was an enormous fire at the scene, attributed, I believe, mostly to the cars that had been caught up in the blast.
It's not clear who was behind the bombing. At least five more people have been pulled alive from the rubble of last week's earthquake in Bam, Iran. Medics from the U.S. have arrived, but John Marty of the U.S. Agency for International Development says medical providers are struggling.
I know the two facilities that are currently doing medical facilities have told us that they're overwhelmed, so they're anxiously waiting for us to get set up to relieve some of the pressure on them and hopefully have more people come in that need the help that we're here to provide.
UN officials say about 40,000 people of an original 103,000 are now left in Bam. Israel is planning to increase the number of settlers in the Golan Heights. The number will go up about 50% over the next 3 years. Syria has denounced the plan. The BBC's Barbara Plett has more from Jerusalem.
Israel plans to build 900 more housing units in the Golan Heights and invest in farming and tourism there. The idea is to expand the existing population of some 17,000 people. Senior Israeli officials said the Golan project was part of a wider rural development scheme drawn up several months ago. They said the fact that it was officially approved now had nothing to do with political developments, such as Syria's recent call to renew peace talks. But critics have accused the government of trying to sabotage any chance of negotiations. And the agriculture minister, Yisrael Katz, said the decision was a clear message that Israel has every intention of strengthening its hold on the Golan Heights.
The BBC's Barbara Plett in Jerusalem. Security is tight across the U.S. this New Year's Eve. In New York, manhole covers have been sealed. WNYC's Jessie Graham is in Times Square. She says security there is especially high.
You can't walk more than 3 feet here without running into a cop, basically. And you're seeing lots of uniformed officers, but actually, Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly also said that there is a larger presence of undercover officers as well. So there's a presence that we're not seeing.
Seven helicopters will patrol over the crowd in Times Square tonight. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed up nearly 29 points to 10,453. The Nasdaq closed down 6 points to 2,003. For the year, the Nasdaq rose 50%. This is NPR. In Britain, musicians, diplomats, and celebrities are celebrating after being honored in the Queen's New Year's list. As part of the annual tradition, hundreds of people are publicly recognized for their contributions to society. Suzanne Chislett reports on one of those honored by the Queen.
Not many people had heard of Tim Berners-Lee until he became a Sir in the honours list, but without him, the world would be a very different place. The scientist pioneered the hypertext program used to share information on the internet, effectively inventing the World Wide Web. Sir Tim, now at MIT in Boston, not only worked on the idea, but ensured it remained free to anyone who wanted to benefit from the web, giving up any money-making rights he may have had. From the entertainment world, Eric Clapton is now a commander of the British Empire for his services turns to music, while the widow of Lord Laurence Olivier becomes Dame Joan Plowright. But despite the celebratory aspect, there is some controversy in Britain about the archaic way the recipients are chosen, and some of the honours date back almost 300 years. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
Scientists are still hoping to hear from the British-built probe, the Beagle 2. It was supposed to land on Mars on Christmas Day after separating from the European Space Agency's Mars Express orbiter. A NASA probe has tried 8 times to contact the lander without success. U.S. lottery officials are waiting for the winner of a Mega Millions jackpot, now worth $162 million, to step forward. The winning ticket was sold in Ohio. The winner can choose between an immediate cash payment of $95 million or $162 million over 26 years. I'm Nancy Marshall, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Margaret Whiting has not only sung many great songs for movies and shows, she grew up around some of the great movie songwriters, including her father, the composer Richard Whiting, who wrote Hooray for Hollywood, My Ideal, Too Marvelous for Words, She's Funny That Way, and The Good Ship Lollipop. Composer Jerome Kern was Uncle Jerry to her. Songwriter Johnny Mercer was like a surrogate father after her father died. Margaret Whiting made her first recordings for Mercer's Capitol label when she was a teenager in the 1940s. Many of her best-known recordings were collected in 2000 on the CD The Complete Capitol Hits of Margaret Whiting. Before we hear the 1987 interview I recorded with Whiting, let's listen to a recording from the late 80s of one of her father's best-known songs, Too Marvelous for Words.
I search for phrases to sing your praises, but there aren't any magic adjectives to tell you all you are. You're just too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, that old standby amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough. Tell enough. I mean, they're just not swell enough. You're much too much and just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Margaret Whiting, I bet you remember when your father wrote that song.
Well, kind of, because I was quite young when he wrote it. He wrote it with Johnny Mercer, and it was for Ruby Keeler in a picture called Ready, Willing, and Able. It had to be before 1938, and I'm not sure the year, but I was still young, but I remember going into my father's studio every day when I came home from school, or when my mother would allow me in, and he would always play what he'd written that day. So I remember hearing it and liking it, and I still do.
Did you assume that all girls had fathers who stayed at the piano most of the day writing songs?
Yes, because my girlfriend was Harry Warren's daughter, and she and I went to school together, and what she had, I had. In other words, one day at my house, I might have Jerome Kern, Uncle Jerry, or I might have Benny Goodman, who my father did a picture for. Or at Harry Warren's, we might have Tommy Dorsey, or we might have Jimmy Dorsey, or we might have Glenn Miller. We might have young Frank Sinatra, Jack Leonard. So I thought everybody, you know, had the same kind of bringing up. I went to school with William Powell's son and Victor McLaughlin's son and all kinds of people like that, Fanny Bryce's daughter and son. So I just thought, well, everybody had a famous parent, and we didn't even think of them as famous. Oh, daddy did this, and my daddy painted that, and my father directed this, or my mother was in this picture. And we were all very calm and cool about it. you know, because we were told not to make a lot of it. But everybody, as I write in my book, I said, I grew up in a factory town because the studios were like factories. I mean, you went to school. If you were in a motion picture, you'd go to the studio at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, makeup, hair, whatever else you did in the picture. The producers would come in early to see a scene. The directors would come in, of course, early. And it was like a factory. And it's not like that anymore. I mean, it's serious and work, but the whole thing of Hollywood has changed.
Did you learn all of your father's songs as soon as they were written?
I think I knew a lot of songs when I was 2 and 3 years old. Well, yes, it would be played around the house, and then the records would be played of it, then people would perform it.
One of your father's better-known songs is on The Good Ship Lollipop, which is, I think, one of his less important songs, but it's a very famous song.
You're right. It is a less important song musically, but it's like it's such a standard because Shirley Temple has lived with so many of us, and that's her biggest song.
Did you have a hard time tolerating Shirley Temple when you were young?
I liked her.
Did you?
I met her, and I went on the set a few times, and she was such a famous person, but such a natural little girl with all those curls, and she had that great sense of humor, and she could tap dance like mad. And my father adored her. But I was responsible for that song. It's strange, but my greatest thrill was to come home and go into the studio and have my father say, well, this is what I've written. And he would play many songs for me. Or he would say, I'm working on this song, and I'm having trouble. Or he would play Cole Porter's new songs that he had gotten hold of, or Richard Rodgers and Larry Hart. But he was having great trouble writing for Shirley Temple because he had to write a very young kind of a melody, and Sidney Clare, who wrote the lyric, was having trouble writing a lyric. They couldn't come up with an idea, in other words, for this child who was this immense movie star. Had to be innocent, had to be fun, had to be cute. I came in with an all-day, you know, a lollipop, a sucker, but it was a lollipop, and I'd had it all over my mouth. I was sucking it on it all the way home from school. So I gave my father a big kiss, and then I was drooling over the piano, and he said, get away from me. Get away from me. You're so sticky. Get rid of that lollipop. Margaret, that's terrible. You're going to get it all over the piano. That's it. That's it. And I thought he'd gone crazy, and he said, that's it. Thank you. Lollipop, lollipop. And he went to the phone, and he called Sidney Clare. He said, Margaret just came in with a big lollipop and got it all over my face and all over the piano. But what a wonderful idea. She gave me the idea. What about Shirley singing on The Good Ship Lollipop? And he was very good at titles. He wrote a couple of lyrics himself. So Sidney said, that's wonderful. I'll call you back. I'll go to work on that. So he said, thank you. He said, give Margaret a big kiss, whether it's sticky or not, and thank her for it. It's a wonderful idea.
Well, you started recording songs when you were a teenager.
Oh, yes.
And they were songs whose lyrics were pretty sophisticated and lyrics about love, like That Old Black Magic. Were you able to comprehend what it was you were singing about as a teenager?
Not really. But I was lucky enough, you know, to have Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer as the composer of that tell me how to do it. Rhythmically, Harold Arlen wrote such great music. I mean, he was really into blues. He and Gershwin were the two composers that wrote that kind of music. And
so what would he tell you?
Well,
when you were
he would tell me to emphasize certain notes and emphasize certain words and emphasize certain beats. Like he said, that old black magic has me in its spell. He said, do it like that. Don't go, that old black magic. Don't make it legato. Phrase it. That old black magic has me in its spell. And Johnny would say, use the word black and emphasize it. That old black magic. So those men just, it's like being in a bind or being in a place where the walls closed in and there was nowhere to go but the right way because they were there teaching me.
That must have just been great.
Oh, it was marvelous. And to have all those kind of songwriters around. Johnny and Frank Lesser taught me the importance of reading a lyric. Johnny Mercer often said to me, Margaret, it's like a one-act play, each song. Now, if it's a rhythm song, then you have fun with it. And you find the words to really emphasize, the important words, and you do it rhythmically, and you have fun. But on a ballad, if it's a torch song or if it's a story that you want to tell, then you've got to be very careful, and you've got to find the climax, where it's going, and do it like a play.
We're listening to a 1987 interview with singer Margaret Whiting. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with singer Margaret Whiting.
I want to play a recent recording of a song that was your first hit, your father's song, My Ideal. You have known the song and have been singing the song for
many years.
What goes through your mind when you sing it now?
To try to make it new and fresh, as if I'm singing it for the first time, because audiences do not know me, some of them. Audiences do not know the song. But more important, really, is that many people do know, and that's one of their memories of me. So I always have to sing it as well, or if not better, than any of the other songs, because that's a memory song to them. And they love the fact my father wrote it and I sang it. So I try to think of... It could be a love when I was a kid, but it's an image of someone that could be my ideal, and will I recognize him? In other words, again, reading the lyric and getting that innocent, honest, first time I ever sang it feeling.
Let's listen to my guest, Margaret Whiting, singing a song written by her father, Richard Whiting. This is My Ideal.
Long ago, my heart and mind got together and a wonderful boy for me. Oh, what a fantasy. Though the idol of my heart can't be ordered a la carte, I wonder if he will be always a fantasy. Never find the boy on my mind, the one who is my ideal. Maybe he's a dream, and yet he may be just around the corner. Recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes reveal, or will I pass him by and never even know that he was my eye? Recognize that light in his eyes that no other eyes reveal. Although he may be late, I'll trust in fate, and so I wait for my.
My Ideal, sung by my guest, Margaret Whiting. It's a really beautiful rendition of it.
Well, it's one of my favorite songs, and it was my father's favorite song. He would play this before he'd start to write something else. He adored this song, and he'd always say, oh, God, I hope I can write another one like it. And there's something kind of special about it. It was my beginning, my roots on records, and I used to sing it before even I started on records. I was on NBC for 2 years with Gordon Jenkins and David Rose conducting for me, and I'd always sing this song along the line because it was one of the first songs I knew, and it kind of fit me. So whenever I sing it, it's special.
I think so many of us grow up with our expectations about what love will be like, with those expectations shaped by the pop songs that we listen to.
And the books we read.
And the books
and
the movies we see.
And the shows we see. And the Valentines we send.
But we sing along with the pop songs. And,
oh, certainly.
And the lyrics just really become part of our visions. Now, you sang those pop songs professionally when you were young. You sang those pop songs before you really knew firsthand
Absolutely.
About love. Did they shape your idea of what love and romance was supposed to be like?
Well, I think that we're all born here with a certain group of rules or a foundation where we would go to school, we would grow up, we would find our first crush in school probably, and it probably wouldn't work out, and eventually we would meet somebody and we would get married and we would have children and it would last forever. And thus is not the case, as most of us find out.
You're pretty frank in your book, and you even write about losing your virginity and how you almost wanted to just get it done with because you'd heard it wasn't so interesting the first time around.
Well, that's right. So that's absolutely true. And you're the first person that's brought that up, but it just was something that I'd heard, you know, that's something to get over with and get on with living. I'm not so sure today. If I knew today what I know at that age, I wouldn't have done it that way.
But I almost had the feeling reading your book that you were doing it to get more of a sense of what the songs were like that you were singing.
I wanted to grow up in it. I wanted to know what love was and sex was and all these words that people were throwing around and living that I wasn't.
All the double entendres in the songs.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's interesting, but it was very sophisticated out in Hollywood, too. And everybody, the group that you live with out there, unlike, let's face it, Hollywood is one place. Hollywood has many people working in many different businesses, bankers, doctors, lawyers, everything. And Los Angeles is a great big city. But in my group, I was raised with people in show business. And it was a certain way of living, and it was much more sophisticated because we were doing make-believe, we were doing pictures, we were doing television, we were doing all these things, and it was what everybody dreamed about. I mean, I've had kids come to me and say, oh, you came from Hollywood. Is Hollywood Boulevard golden?
So tell me, did having sex change your interpretation of songs?
I think so. I think I said, oh, that's what it's all about.
You came of age professionally during World War II.
Yes, absolutely.
And even, I think, toured a few times with Bob Hope.
Oh, I toured with him. I was with him for 7 years. So I toured a lot of places with Bob Hope.
What did you learn from those tours, both about show business and about things like timing?
Oh, everything. When you work with someone like Eddie Cantor, and I was fortunate enough to work with Eddie and Jack Carson, and then Hope, if you start to move on a line, he grabs you. He says, never move on a line because the audience watches the movement.
You mean like on a punchline?
Yes. Well, or anything. If you're gonna go back and forth. Hey, Bob, I heard you went to Camp Jun today. Did you have a good time? And if I start moving, whatever he's going to say, they're going to pay attention to me. They're not going to hear the punchline. And timing is such an important thing. I learned it from Red Skelton. Learned it from all these marvelous geniuses, Jack Benny, that I worked with.
We only have a couple of minutes left. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about singing. You grew up the daughter of one of the great American composers, Richard Whiting. Your extended family were some of the greatest composers, Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer. Did you grow up thinking that to sing a song you really had to stick to the composer's intention, stick to what was on the page, but the lyric and the music. Because a lot of singers will stray from that and will reinterpret a song.
Well, I reinterpret now. But I certainly did stick to what they said because my father said to me, look, sing the songs the way we wrote them. Took us a long time. That's our craft. We're professional. And that stuck with me. And, of course, Johnny and Harold and everybody said, you know, sing in the way we wrote them or the way we sing them as we teach them to you. But recently I've had more of a jazz sound and gone in a little bit different direction, as has Rosemary Clooney. But I think we're still singing them traditionally, but in a different way. I mean, I'm not going to louse up a lyric because I adore those lyrics. And I'm certainly not going to, I may bend a note here and there, but I'm going to give it a different conception, but within the architecture of the song, the foundation of the song, because that's the way I was taught. But stylists are the people that take a song the way I sing it and then do it completely differently, and bravo for them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing so much about your life with us.
Well, I had a ball. I really had a ball. I enjoyed it.
Margaret Whiting recorded in 1987. Here's her 1960 recording of the Jerome Kern song, Look for the Silver Lining. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Look for the silver lining when e'er a cloud appears in the blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so the right thing to do is make it shine for you, a heart full of joy and gladness. Can always banish.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. And from Dutton, publisher of The Lady and the Unicorn, the new novel by Tracy Chevalier, author of Girl with a Pearl Earring, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our series Songs from Hollywood and Broadway continues with an interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. Several of his movie songs were hits for Sinatra, including Come Fly With Me and All the Way. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a series of original Broadway cast recordings of shows that flopped, which have songs that shouldn't be forgotten.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue our series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, with a 1985 interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. He died in 93 at the age of 79. Most of his songs are written for movies. They include I Fall in Love Too Easily, Let It Snow, Day by Day, Time After Time, It's Magic, Be My Love, Teach Me Tonight, The Tender Trap, All the Way, Come Fly With Me, The Second Time Around, and Call Me Irresponsible. In addition to his movie songs, Kahn wrote for big bands, vaudeville, and singers. Several of his songs were written for Frank Sinatra. Kahn had his most successful and enduring partnerships with composers Saul Chaplin, Julie Stein, and Jimmy Van Heusen. Kahn would sing his songs at the slightest provocation. Whenever he was commissioned to write a song for a particular singer, he would insist on performing it for him to show him what he had in mind. When it was time to demonstrate a song for a great singer, Kahn never lacked confidence, even if the singer was Frank Sinatra.
I sing the song for the first time, and I stand in front of Sinatra, and I am a lethal demonstrator. I'm lethal. I don't know if you understand the true meaning. When I stand in front of you and take my posture, I am ready. I know my part. And if you have any sense of words and music, first of all, I wouldn't stand in front of you to begin with unless I was ready. And I will say to you, we have the song for so-and-so. For instance, one of the most memorable moments of demonstrating songs is when I sang the songs to Our Town. Our Town for the first time. I'll never forget, we came and we sang to him. It was kind of around twilight time. I'll never forget. It was kind of quiet. With no one around, just him sitting in an easy chair. And when Sinatra reflects, he rolled the bottom of his thumb over his lower lip. And that's how he reflects. And his highest praise is, high praise. And he doesn't turn down a song, never has.
Did he ever want to change a lyric that you wrote?
Only one time.
Which one was that?
That's in the song, one of my very, very favorite songs, The Last Dance. We started the idea of writing an opening song for an album and a closing song for an album. Like Come Fly With Me. Opens with Come Fly With Me, of course, and the closing song, which is It's Nice to Go Traveling. So, and then we wrote Come Dance With Me. And then we needed a closing song. And we quickly discovered that Irving Berlin, the legendary Irving Berlin, I discovered that he'd written every song you can possibly write about dancing. Cheek to Cheek, Change Partners, I'm Putting On My Top Hat. So usually I write a song very, very swiftly, but here I am and I can't come up with the last song. Finally I turned to Van Heusen one day, I said, has there ever been a song called The Last Dance? And Van Heusen, who's very, very familiar with the literature of songs, said, no. It's been the Save the Last Waltz for me, but not the last. I said, sit down. I said, it's the last dance. We've come to the last dance. They're dimming the lights down. They're hoping we'll go. It's obvious they're aware of us, the pair of us, alone on the floor. But I want to hold you like this forevermore. So Sinatra is recording this song. And I had lines that they're wondering just when will we leave, but till we leave, keep holding me tight through the last dance, each beat of the last dance, and save me the first dance in your dreams tonight. So it, when you speak, you would say, they're wondering just when we will leave. You wouldn't say, they're wondering just when will we leave. So he said, they're wondering just when we will leave. I said, no, it isn't. If I hold it. I said, they're wondering just when will we leave. but till we leave. He said, what kind of cockamamie word is... I said, no one speaks like that. I said, no. I said, no one speaks like that, but we aren't speaking, Frank, are we? We're singing, aren't we, Frank? And that's the only time we ever kind of good-naturedly quarreled about a line.
It's the last dance. We've come to the last dance. They're dimming the lights down. They're hoping we'll go. It's obvious they're aware of us. The pair of us alone on the floor. Still I want to hold you like this forever and more. It's the last song. They're playing the last song. The orchestra's yawning. They're sleepy, I know. Just when will we leave, but till we leave, keep holding me tight through the last dance. Each beat of the last dance, save me the first dance in your dreams tonight.
Frank Sinatra singing the Sammy Kahn, Jimmy Van Heusen song, The Last Dance. Let's return to my conversation with the late Sammy Kahn, recorded in 1985.
Is there a song that you've written that you're proudest of the rhymes you were able to come up with?
Yes, the one I tell everyone, the one I'm very, very proud of is Call Me Irresponsible, simply because I am wont to say, and it's not as facetious as it sounds, is that it has five-syllable words in it. Call me unpredictable. Tell me I'm impractical. I said five-syllable words from a fellow who came from a one-syllable neighborhood.
You know what I love in that song? Throw in undependable, too. I love the throw in. How did you get that?
It's
so vernacular.
Every song, as I say in the rhyming dictionary, every song, the title dictates the architecture of the song. If you say the title is Call Me Irresponsible, da 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 da, that's the architecture. Now, that song started off, Call Me Irresponsible, Call Me Undependable, Throw In Unreliable, no. Throw an unreliable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? While I'm not too clever, I just adore you. Call me unpredictable. Tell me I'm impractical. Rainbows I'm inclined to pursue. Call me irresponsible. Yes, I'm undependable, but it's undeniably true. I said, you know, Jim, if I had Reliable down there, undeniable, coming after unreliable would be better. So we switched the two lines on top. I call that neatening up a song. So we changed the two lines on top so I would have, call me irresponsible, yes, I'm unreliable, but it's undeniably true. That's called graceful and very gratifying to the ear.
We're listening back to a 1985 interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1985 interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. He told me about writing the song Be My Love for the singer Mario Lanza for the 1950 film Toast of New Orleans.
In this instance, the music was already written in ink. Love theme for Lanza. Dee-da-dee, dee-dee-da-da-da. Every note was written, not in pencil, which you can erase and make a change. Written in ink. Love theme for Lanza. By this very, very talented little Hungarian, Nicholas Brodsky, friend of Joseph Pasternak, another little Hungarian. And I was called in to put a lyric to this melody. And I'm very, very, very proud of that lyric. Because you listen to that lyric again, I tell people that I don't write a lyric as much as the lyric writes me. I happen to be in the room while it's happening, so I'm very fortunate to be able to claim the royalties, if you know what I mean. But think about it. The title is Be My Love. They're absolutely singing words. Be my love. You can sing every one of them. For no one else can end this yearning, this need that you and you alone create. Every one of those words, you can bite them and chew them. Now, I don't know if you realize that when I wrote that lyric, not a word rhymes.
Gosh, you're right. I hadn't realized that before.
Just fill my arms the way you fill my dreams. There's no rhymes yet. We're halfway through a song. First rhyme. The dreams that you inspire with every sweet desire. And I'm not rolling my R's the way opera people love to do. Now I rhyme the whole song. Be my love, and with your kisses set me burning, yearning, burning. One kiss is all I need to seal my fate, create fate. I rhyme the song in the after song. Yeah. Now, listen how every word fits the mouth and really singing words. And a hand in a hand, we'll find love's promised land. There'll be no one but you. Ooh, ooh, sound is very good on the high notes. For me, eternal. Now, Lanza, who had a voice that you could not believe unless you heard it in person. No mechanical reproduction of this voice does it any justice. In a room with him, it was a staggering experience. So, there'll be no one but you for me. Eternally, he added that. Eternally, if you will be my love. It's a high C, I don't know. It's just, now, as I say to you, he knew every note of that song. He didn't know the lyric. I had the lyric. And you know what chutzpah is. You know what chutzpah means? That's cheek or gall. Chutzpah, the classic version is, the ancient version is, this chap kills his parents and he pleads for mercy because he's an orphan. That's classic chutzpah. But modern chutzpah is me singing to Mario Lanza. Well, that's some chutzpah of some kind. So Mario looked at me after I talk sang Be My Love for the first time. He took the lyric out of my hand as contemptuously as you can take a lyric out of someone's hand. And he sang Be My Love back at me. And I tell you, that was an experience.
Be my love, for no one else can end this yearning, this need that you and you
just fill my arms the way you filled my dreams, the dreams that you inspire with every sweet desire. Hand in hand, we'll find love's promised land. There'll be no one but you for me.
Written a rhyming dictionary. Did you actually use one? Would you ever use one when
I
you
always
writing?
Had a rhyming dictionary.
Yeah?
For the composer. That's the truth.
Really?
I always felt, I personally, I always felt that if I couldn't think of the word, I shouldn't use it. But the composer used to say to me, every time I was writing, the composer used to say to me, you have a rhyming dictionary? I said, sure, here it is. Give it to the composer.
Right, I get it. Are there words that you really avoid because you know they're unrhymable?
No, every word is rhymable. Rhymable, rhymable. Take a simple name like Nicholas. You can rhyme it with ridiculous if you aren't too meticulous. You know, every word's rhymable.
The late lyricist Sammy Kahn recorded in 1985. Here he is singing his song The Tender Trap, which he co-wrote with the composer Jimmy Van Heusen. This is from a 1972 recording of his appearance at the 92nd Street Y's Lyrics and Lyricists series.
You see a pair of laughing eyes, and suddenly your silence sighs. You're thinking nothing's wrong, you string along, boy, then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender trap. You're hand in hand beneath the trees, and soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kind of smart until your heart just goes whap. Are those trees, that breeze, they're part of the tender trap. Some starry night when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight and you'll hate yourself for being single. Then all at once it seems so nice, the folks are throwing shoes and rice. You hurry to a spot that's just a dot on the map. You wonder how it all came about. It's too late now, there's no getting out. You fell in love, and love is the tender trap.
Coming up, forgotten Broadway shows with memorable songs. This is Fresh Air. not all the best Broadway songs come from the most famous shows. Some recently reissued Broadway cast albums help explain why some shows didn't succeed. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that some forgotten shows have numbers that shouldn't be.
When I was a kid growing up in New York, I fell in love with Broadway. If a show looked good on paper, my family would get tickets before it opened. Every now and then, we'd get stuck with a clinker. One show, Seventh Heaven, which was inspired by a famous silent movie, had a pretty score by Hollywood's Victor Young, and a cast that included Gloria DeHaven, Ricardo Montalban, and a remarkable young dancer named Cheetah Rivera, 2 years before West Side Story made her a star. But it got such bad reviews, it closed after only 44 performances. The cast album disappeared almost as quickly. It's been a collector's item. But it's just been reissued on CD, and there are some delightful numbers. Here's Camille, Colette, Fifi, in which three Parisian hookers express their philosophy. Guess which one is Cheetah Rivera? Another show I saw that seemed to have even greater potential for success was Fade Out, Fade In. An affectionate satire of Hollywood in the 30s, it starred Carol Burnett and had music by Jules Stein with book and lyrics by Betty Comden and Adolph Green, famous for another Hollywood satire, Singin' in the Rain. During the run, Burnett was injured in a taxi accident and started missing performances. Then she signed up for a TV show. Fade Out, Fade In actually closed, then reopened when Burnett was legally forced to return. But it never recovered its lost momentum. The long out-of-print cast recording has finally been issued on CD. One song is a gem. You mustn't be discouraged, with Burnett and dancer Tiger Haynes imitating a nauseatingly optimistic number by Shirley Temple and Bill Bojangles Robinson.
When you think you've hit the bottom and you're feeling really low, you mustn't be discouraged. There's always one step further down you can go.
Both Seventh Heaven and Fade Out, Fade In are part of Decca's marvelous series of reissued cast albums. One new disc includes three musicals from the World War II era. Irving Berlin's This Is the Army, from 1942, features Berlin himself singing a song that he resurrected from a musical he wrote during World War I.
A soldier quite a while, and I would like to state the life is simply wonderful. The army food is great. I sleep with 97 others in a wooden hut. I love them all. They all love me. It's very lovely, but oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how I'd love to remain in bed. For the hardest blow of all is to hear the bugler call. You gotta get up, you gotta get up, you gotta get up this morning. Someday
in 1946, Harold Rome wrote a musical about the transition to civilian life called Call Me Mister. The number I can't get enough of features the delectable Betty Garrett lamenting the recent craze for Latin American dances.
Take back your samba, aye, your conga, aye, your rumba, aye, aye, aye. I'm dislocating, aye, my verta, aye, brelumba, aye, aye, aye. I got more bumps here, aye, than on a, aye, cucumber, aye, aye, aye. Though I lack neighborly relations, all these up and down gyrations try my patience. Olé! I think it's time to call a truce. I'm telling you, I'm shaking loose my poor caboose. Olé! All of this going and this coming to this fancy Latin drumming numbs my plumbing. Olé! South America!
Another Decca album has two shows with lyrics by the great Dorothy Fields. The highlight is The Fireman's Bride, a surprisingly naughty number from Up in Central Park, with music by Sigmund Romberg. It's sung by Celeste Holm, who wasn't actually in the original cast, though it seems written especially for her.
Fireman Joe McGee, who married in June, wants to be free. He bought a handsome love nest, but his high-flying spouse likes the firehouse. She wears a crimson skirt, a fireman's hat, red flannel shirt. Clang goes the bell and she's off, boys, in a cloud of confusion and dirt. Oh, the fireman's bride, the fireman's bride won't sit home by her fireside. From all accounts, she'd rather bounce in the fireman's net. She leaps to the engine and clings to the hose. How she hangs on, nobody knows. Out comes the net and then over she goes. High up they throw her while she hollers, "Mower!"
I really love listening to these old shows. Even the worst of them, with their combination of showbiz savvy and corny innocence, are a kind of unconscious history, revealing something about the time they were written. And then, if we're lucky, there's the one cherishable song that transcends all the foolishness that surrounds it.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches at the University of Massachusetts at Boston and is classical music editor at the Boston Phoenix. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy and healthy new year.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Washington and Caesar, a novel set during the American Revolution by Christian Cameron. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate the new year with a Randy Newman performance and interview. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not.